Hello there, good evening and welcome to the show. Firstly, big thanks to Demi and Mikey for driving us into the weekend. It is Friday, October 3rd. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the official chart show at 7pm, Paul Corrie reflects on an historic Conference League night for Shelburne and Shamrock Rovers, where Fergal Brennan joins the conversation for our Premier League preview. Plus, Tony O'Donoghue dials in from Turner's Cross ahead of Cork City's FAI Cup clash with St Pat's. Jane Mangan previews a weekend of big money racing in Paris, plus Ellen Keane reviews the Para-Athletic World Championships and we'll hear from Ireland's Orla Comerford. All that and the latest sports news headlines on this evening's Game On. As always, if you want to have your say, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 087 187 9200 or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
This is Game On indeed. Happy Friday, one and all. Hope you are enjoying your Friday as best you can, despite the storm. Some match postponements actually due to the adverse weather conditions, just to inform you. Well, Shamrock Rovers will not be crowned League of Ireland champions tonight as Derry City's League of Ireland clash with Sligo Rovers at the Roy McBride Brandywell Stadium is postponed until Sunday at 4pm. Tonight's other Premier Division fixture between Waterford and Drogheda United is also off and will take place at 4pm on Sunday. Two First Division fixtures off, Treaty United against Longford Town and Wexford at home to UCD. They'll kick off at 4pm Sunday. Also, while in the URC, Ulster's match away to Edinburgh, scheduled for tonight, has been postponed due to Storm Amy. Paul Corrie, it's not often, Paul, that I'm jealous of yourself and other football fans getting to watch League of Ireland teams on the telly, but from standing in the North Stand last night in the lashings of rain, I was just thinking, I would love to be on my couch right now.
Yeah, it can be a very cold place, Tallaght Stadium, when the weather isn't great, Shane. It was a nice dilemma to have at being at home and wondering which League of Ireland side you're going to watch on the telly.
Which League of Ireland side to watch in a Conference League stage? That is the perfect dilemma.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah. It was brilliant. I watched the first half of Shamrock Rovers and then once they went 2-0 down, switched over to watch your beloved Shelburne in the testing conditions out in Tallaght. But it's, I mean, we've plenty more of it to come, but it was just brilliant to witness both sides in action.
Yeah. In understrength, Shamrock Rovers team, were you surprised with some of the selection decisions by Stephen Bradley?
Yeah, I was very surprised, Shane. I wonder if Bradley had the game back again, would he go with the same 11? I was very surprised, you know, the fact that Watts, Mandrew and Burke were all on the bench. And you think about going away...
He did mention that is with an eye to a massive cup semi-final against Kerry.
Yeah.
Listen.
I want to be respectful here.
There's a gulf in class, obviously, between Premier Division and First Division teams, but it's a cup semi-final. It could be a wet and windy Tallaght Stadium where anything can happen.
Yeah, it could be. If it was in Tralee, I could maybe understand the selection a little bit more. I think the fact that they're at home in their own surroundings, listen, they've got a great squad and they've a great, you know, bunch of players to select from. Even when you look at some of the players who didn't come onto the pitch last night, they would start for a lot of League of Ireland sides. But I think last night, looking at the opposition they were up against, they needed their strongest 11 on the park. I didn't feel like the midfield three of Nugent, Healy and McInniff worked. I didn't think there was that sort of presence in the middle of the park to just buy a pass or two to take the sting out of the game, get yourselves up the pitch. McGovern started up top, he hasn't played a huge amount of games from the start. They really miss Lee Grace at the back. That is evident with his injury at this moment in time. But I'm just a little bit confused as to why he went with that team. I can only imagine, Shane, that it was the fact that Darren Nugent is a very powerful runner. Aaron McInniff is similar in that sense, and maybe he wanted that physicality about the park to maybe disrupt Sparta Prague and get themselves up the pitch with hard running and being physical. But they definitely missed that sort of technical aspect in the middle of the pitch. And you saw when Burke, Manju and Dylan Watts came onto the pitch, it was a completely different game. They created chances once after that kind of 60-minute mark. Manju obviously gets his goal. There was too big of a gap between the sides. But yeah, I was a little bit confused by the 11 that Stephen Bradley went with. He'll also be really disappointed with the goals he gave away. I mean, Pico Lopez was terribly a fault for the first goal, very uncharacteristic. And I thought, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but goalkeepers union, Ed McGuinty, I thought he should have just caught it for the second one. He's kind of patted down into a dangerous area. And it's hard to be too critical of both these players, because in recent weeks and months they've been excellent. But at that level, when you're playing that quality opposition, you need your best players on the park, and you can't afford to make mistakes like they did.
Yeah, a good point for Shelburne to open their Conference League campaign, or 2 points dropped?
I only caught the second half. I think Joey would be delighted, first and foremost, to get a point and get themselves off the mark. Not only financially, like the financial rewards, what was it,
133,000. 400 for a win, 133 for a draw.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing sums of money to come into the football club. But yeah, I thought Hacken were there for the taking. I'm not sure what you felt. Maybe it just needed a moment of magic, or just a bit of good play like they had up in Linfield for Harry Wood's goal, to maybe just unlock Hacken, and maybe it just didn't happen for them in that sense. But I think not to lose the game and to keep a clean sheet is really going to have to be the foundation for Shells if they're going to get points within this group stage. I mean, the one thing that has disappointed me with them, and I'm sure for fans as well, is the nature of some of the goals and the chances that they've given away in previous games, particularly in Europe, but also in the league. They work really hard. They're very much within games, and then it's just individual moments or uncharacteristic mistakes that have kind of gifted oppositions, important moments or goals within games. So it was a great point. It feels like the first couple of games, Shane, they do need to pick up points, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm correct in saying that.
In North Macedonia at the end of the month, and then Drita, you'd probably be targeting those matches. It was 7 points last year to progress. Might be something similar this
you're
year.
You're talking about progression.
I'm posing the question. You're saying targeting the first three matches. Listen, Cork City and St. Pat's are looking for progression to the Sports Direct Events FAI Cup final.
You just want to know who you're playing in the knockout rounds.
Credit Union's looking worried. Tony O'Donoghue is at Cork City. He's at Turner's Cross for us ahead of this evening's semi-final live on RT television. What's the weather like in Cork? This match going ahead, Tony?
The match is going ahead, thankfully. Yeah, the weather has been rotten all day, as it has been around the country. Worst, I think, on the west and the northwest coast. The rain was hammering down all day. Still very windy, but the rain has stopped and the pitch actually looks fine. Now, whether it cuts up as the players do their warm-up and in the early stage of the match, we'll have to wait and see. David Myler probably isn't helping things. He's the assistant manager at Cork City now, and he's putting in those, you know, those, what are they called? What's the technical term, Paul Corry, for what looks like a man with spikes at the end that you stick into the turf?
A mannequin?
As if a mannequin, perhaps. Although I always think a mannequin is something that you have to blow up. Maybe not.
That's what they were calling my training ground anyway, Tony.
So that's what Myler is doing at the moment. And, you know, perhaps not helping the turf for later on. But it's a huge night. Well, for both sides, actually, of course, because it's a cup semi-final. But it's a huge night, in particular, I think, for Cork City, because the season has been absolute pants. It's been terrible. Relegation is, a certainty, really. I guess there's only one consolation with Waterford's game against Drogheda being called off. At least that eliminates the possibility of they being relegated, confirmed relegated tonight. But they will be relegated. So for the long-suffering Cork City fans, a chance of upsetting the odds and beating St. Pat's here and making it to an Aviva Cup final and potentially a place in Europe despite relegation. Well, would it be a consolation from what's been a dreadful season? The fans, we're told, are planning a pre-match protest, and that's kind of aimed at the club owner rather than the players, they say. Since I arrived at the ground, there's been a lot of talk about it. Apparently there was something of a whip around, and it might be something thrown onto the pitch. Do you remember that famous tennis ball protest the Irish fans had a number of years ago about the FAI? There might be something similar. So we're due to kick off here at 7:30, and we hope we do kick off, because whatever the fans' right to protest and all that, I mean, I do think what they want is to support the team and the players and to see if they can upset the odds and beat St. Pat's. The last time, it's only 11 days ago that these two sides met in league competition in Inchicore. And it wasn't just the 4-0 scoreline. I mean, Pats were so much more superior. Since then, they have lost their last game, which was against Galway. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. Against Sligo, rather, forgive me. Cork have lost their last game as well against Galway. Patchy form for both sides coming into it. But the good news anyway is that the rain has stopped. The pitch looks good for the moment, and we have a game on.
Paul Corrie was alluding to the gulf in class between Rovers and Kerry, and perhaps that would be the shock of all shocks if Kerry were to overturn Shamrock Rovers and Tallaght Sailing. But how big of a shock would it be if Cork City were to come out on top this evening?
Their home form recently, and it's something that Ger Nash, the manager, has referred to in the match programme. They have managed in the last four games, they've won three and drawn one, and that draw was against Shamrock Rovers. So they do feel that the Turner's Cross factor might be a help to them. They hope that certainly, but the supporters and how this mooted protest goes might be a factor there if the supporters do get behind the team tonight. In the good days, the shed behind the Cork City team was often like an extra man. And you'd like to think that might be the case. But I understand that Pats have nearly 1,000 people and good luck to them coming down the country in weather like today. But I think there's between 900 and 1,000 Pats fans here. So there should be a cracking atmosphere. It's live on RTE television as well, of course. But it would be, a big shock. I mean, Pats under Stephen Kenny, who, by the way, is managing his 1,000th game, which is a phenomenal achievement. And look at the success that he's had, particularly domestically. He's looking to land his fourth FAI Cup. Pat's by far the team with more talent, you'd imagine, with better form until their last game. But it's the Cup, and anything can happen. And, Paul, you were alluding to it. Kerry coming from behind, coming from 3-0 behind to beat Sligo Rovers, that was an extraordinary, the result of the season, really. And if they can go on and do anything like that again on Sunday against a Shamrock Rovers side, who, as you were saying, were far from the anywhere near their best last night in Prague. Well, if they can do it again, we could be looking at a Kerry Cork final. That'd be a fantasy final for me. Maybe we'd have to consider moving it out of the Aviva and down to Parky Cueve.
Who knows? We shall see. 7:30 kickoff in Turner's Cross. Tony O'Donoghue, thank you so much for joining us. As I mentioned, live on RTE television and indeed the RTE player. Who'd you fancy, Polly? Are you going with the favourites?
Well, most importantly, somebody let Tony know that if David Moyler asks, it is a football mannequin.
Mannequin. Yeah. Okay. Okay, right. Credit to Paul. This is why we have you on the show as a former professional footballer.
This is according to my AI app here beside me. I just had to double check that. It did come back with soccer mannequin, but...
Association football mannequin. Yeah. I'll allow that.
Someone let Tony know.
I'll allow that. 1,000 match in charge for Stephen Kenny going down to Turner's Cross, Cork City. As Tony mentioned there's going to be fan protests. They've been simmering for a while. A bit of anger and frustration, I think, with the Cork ownership at the moment. And obviously, Waterford. So Cork could be relegated on Sunday if Waterford defeat Drogheda United, because that match postponed until 4 o'clock Sunday. But for tonight, what way are you thinking? Who are you siding with?
Do you know what? The conditions could be a bit of a leveller tonight. And I'd say Cork are keen to have this game go ahead, not only because it's a massive occasion and it's on the television like you mentioned, but also I think the conditions could level it out a bit. Like, St. Pat's are very much a team, and Stephen Kenny's sides have always traditionally been sides who want to get the ball down and play out from the back and play through the thirds and make the pitch nice and big. It's not always easy to do that when the pitch can be a little bit boggy or the wind is up, so that could affect the performance there. Tony mentioned the result that they had recently against Shamrock Rovers. I think that's the sort of performance you need to replicate. St. Pat's are not Shamrock Rovers, they're not at the same level, but there's still a little bit of a gap between the sides. Cork need to hang in, they need to make sure that they're still in the game. If they go behind, you got to ensure that Pats don't score a second goal, and then you hope that the likes of a Seanan Maguire or an Alex Nolan, you got players there at the top end of the pitch who can produce moments, and particularly Cup semi-final, Shane, like, anything can happen. Form doesn't completely go out the window, but occasions like this, daft things can happen, or players can come up with moments of magic. But you would have to lean in favour of St. Pat's purely on the basis of the result in Richmond a couple of weeks ago. It was a 4-0 thumping. Cork hardly got out of second gear. Some of the mistakes they made for the goals were punished. You've got Mason Melia, who's in great form. You'd have to lean in favour of Stephen Kenny's side, but they have disappointed at different moments throughout this season. So it's definitely not a foregone conclusion, but certainly a game that you would expect Pats to have the upper hand in.
Okay, teams just in on the FEI Connect app. Very briefly, just a quick run through. Cork, Brannan, goal. Lions, Bulger, McLaughlin, Nolan, Nelson, Crowley, Fitzpatrick, Anderson, Shawnee McGuire, as I mentioned, captain side, and Feely. St. Pat's, Joey Nang in goal. Joe Redmond is their captain. Gravosti, Lennon, Chris Forrester, Mason Melia, Levy, McClelland, Garrick, McLaughlin, and Simon Power. Both starting 11s for this evening's match. 51552 is the text number. Expecting a great cup tie tonight in Turniss Cross, as one text. Every point is so lucrative for Shamrock Rovers and Shelburne in Europe. Indeed it is. And the Victor Osionvune transfer today just shows the potential of the League of Ireland and the possibility of a real footballing industry in Ireland. That of course is the news that Arsenal have completed a record breaking deal to sign the 16 year old from Shamrock Rovers. He will move to Arsenal when he turns 18 for a guaranteed fee believed to be in the region of €2 million, along with potential or an even bigger payday with add-ons and a reported 20% sell-on clause. He'll link up at Arsenal in January 2027 transfer window and will remain Rovers until then. Great boost for Rovers that he remains with them until he turns 18.
Yeah, it's huge. And we were just chatting off air and listening to some of Stephen Bradley's interviews. He has said that he is, you know, intentionally left Victor out of squads and held him back because he didn't want too much limelight being on him. I'm also certain that they probably didn't want him to get or pick up any injuries in advance of that deal. But saw a small bit of him throughout the season, and the one game that really stands out in my mind is the Bowes Rovers game in the Aviva. He came on with probably about 25-30 minutes to go.
When no one really knew.
No one knew about him.
Yeah.
He came on the pitch and was almost, you know, who's this? But he picked up the ball once or twice and he just breeze past people down the left hand side. He actually should have scored in that game. There was a ball that was pulled across the 6 yard box. I'm pretty certain it was Victor. Could have been Noonan. And you saw the spark that obviously Arsenal have seen with it, and I'm sure there was more clubs who were interested. But it's brilliant for Rovers to kind of piggyback off the business that's been done with Gavin Bizunu, Mason Melia. The transfer fees are going up. The money in England is just getting absolutely ridiculous. Like €2 million is not an awful lot of money to Arsenal, but it's a huge amount of money to a League of Ireland side. They've got Michael Noonan in the back pocket. He will be the next one to go, Shane. I've absolutely no doubt about that. Centre forwards, goal scorers always go for big sums. But it's amazing for Victor, and it's a testament to the work that has been done within the League of Ireland academies as a whole. Mm. And you just hope that...
How good is timing, actually, considering we have a budget around the corner? Will Clark is doing Trojan work within the FEI for League of Ireland Academies. Owen Doyle actually has a great piece on the RT Sport website. I encourage anyone to give that a read. But just the timing of it, seeing that we have players here for those price tags.
Yeah, and I think we've always had players who've come through, even when I was growing up in schoolboy football. The benefit now when looking for funding is the fact that they're within the League of Ireland clubs, and you're talking about resources, you're talking about facilities, and you're talking about giving, you know, kids in particular the best opportunity they can have of going on and having careers. But what you start to see then is if you put the money into the clubs, and there has been money put into Shamrock Rovers to develop those facilities, they're starting to reap the rewards of that, and ultimately the club can then maybe help pay for itself with the transfer fees that they're able to bring in for the likes of Victor and particular Gavin Bizunu who've gone over
and
the last
couple of
years.
That's coming in from Europe as well
and
for Rovers.
Yeah, and that's not going to be the same for every club, but if clubs can continue to produce, like you see dotted across, I know we're probably up on time here, dotted across the league, you have the likes of an Elding at Sligo Rovers. Yeah. Like that's one that will probably go for big money. You've had Mason Melia, you've got Michael Newland.
Davis was linked with a move across from Drogheda.
Yeah, you've obviously had the contingent of Bows who've come through, the likes of Tierney and Devoy, and yes, they're back, but they went at one point across the water. You would hope that lessons have been learned. People are tying down the best young talent to longer contracts, and that is now commanding bigger fees. There's obviously, like, the resources in the UK are just absolutely ridiculous with the top clubs, what they can afford to do. So we have to try to get a small percentage of that cake, and ultimately how you do that, Shane, is investment in those facilities. So you're dead right to say that's the sort of business case that you bring into government to say this is what you get out of it. That would produce internationals. Like, that's where our internationals are going to come from further down the line. Yeah. Because we can't send players across the water now with Brexit.
That is the point that I think people are trying to drive home from within League of Ireland circles, that this isn't just a benefit to the League of Ireland, that this is going to be a national issue, that down the line we will create those players and we can hopefully have more positive.
And right now, our players being developed in Ireland is not necessarily a good thing for the international team.
Yes, because of facilities
and
coaches and everything that they have and lack of...
And we might not feel the pinch. Like, the international team is suffering at the moment, but there's a bit of a drain on the talent because we haven't been able to post players into top Premier League clubs. Anyway, we'll be here till 8 p.m. if we
talking about how dark it can get before there will be light at the tunnel. There's no light at the tunnel at the moment until
another international window coming up very soon.
We had lots to look forward to when we're previewing Hamer Halkomson's Ireland team shortly. Listen, staying with soccer, former Republic of Ireland defender Niamh Fahey has been appointed Liverpool FC Women's first technical coordinator. The Galway woman made 125 appearances for the club, lifting the FA Women's Championship trophy in 2022. The club described the position as being a key role in shaping and supporting the future technical direction of the club's women's programme, including a focus on player development, recruitment, strategic planning and enhancing the pathway from the club's pro game academy into the first team. Brilliant news for Niamh, who was captain in the last 5 years. She was 7 years at Liverpool, captain for the last 5 years. UEFA B licence, I think, and a load of kind of from the business side of things. So brilliant news for former Republic of Ireland international Niamh Fahey. What else happened last night? We can cover it in our English football chat later with Fergal Brennan, but wins for Palace in the Conference League and a defeat for Forest. Andrew, under a bit of pressure?
It was a bonkers move to bring him in the first place. Like, the success they had last year under Nuno was based on being defensively sound, a low block, hitting teams on the counter-attack with Alanga and Hudson-Odoi's pace, and then you bring in the most open manager possible in Ange Postecoglou, who doesn't fit the players that they have in their squad. So don't be surprised that the results are as poor as they are, and it might take a little bit of time to actually turn that around. But are you really surprised at Marinakis?
I think it helps that he's friends with the owner, perhaps.
Yeah, well, he might need that.
We'll cover that in detail later on with Fergal Brennan. Up next, Ellen Keane is standing by. We're going to hear from Orla Comerford, a double world champion, and reflect on the World Para Athletics Championship. Stick with us here in Game On.
RTE 2FM. Game On. Athletics.
Now, Ellen Keane is with us to reflect on the World Para Athletics Championships that yielded 3 gold medals and a personal best. So it's fair to say it was a successful championships from an Irish perspective.
It was, and it was so exciting to see because the first 2 gold medals came on the day that the rowers got their gold medals. So it was a day full of gold on Sunday. First up was Greta Strymekete. She has had a hard kind of couple of years of constantly coming fourth, and I used to live with Greta and I had such a pleasure in seeing what a hard worker she is. She trains so hard. She fuels her body so well. She's always recovering. She's always putting her sport first. So to see her finally not only get a medal, she's gotten a couple of medals throughout the years, but to finally get a gold medal, especially last year in Paris, she came fourth. So honestly, it was just such an emotional thing to see. And then following that was Orla Comerford upgrading her bronze medal from Paris last year to a gold in a championship record time. Unbelievable stuff. And there was a newbie on the team as well. So Lana Sutton, this is her first major international. She would have gone over to Paris with the younger guys just to see what the Paralympics is all about and kind of get inspired. So it was really interesting to see how you can get inspired by watching the Paralympic Games and then the next year go and compete for Ireland at the at the World Championships and make a final. So it was an unbelievable championships. And then Orla has just also picked up the 200 metres. Now, she's a sprinter, so it's not that different for her to be able to kind of progress in the 200, but to win the gold medal in the 200 metres as well. Unbelievable time.
Double world champion. Unbelievable. Let's hear from Orla Comfort now. You've been speaking to her, Ellen.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Orla, how are you? Has it sunk in?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, no, it certainly hasn't sunk in, to answer that question. I think it might take me a little bit of time. Like, it's so surreal. I think it's just like when you live your life and your career for so many years dreaming of these moments, then when they actually happen, it's hard to actually believe what's going on. And, you know, they've been a dream for so long. So when they're a reality, it feels bizarre, but amazing.
In the lead up, did you have like an inkling that perhaps it might happen? And were you like maybe a little bit afraid to say it out loud in case you jinxed it?
Well, look, I think, to be honest, like, the thing is, most athletes are always going to have ambitions that are beyond what others' expectations are. And I think going into the game or these championships, I was like, God, like, it would be amazing to come away with 2 medals. That would be, you know, that would be a result I'd be really happy with. But I suppose for myself, I wanted the colour of those to be upgraded from the Paris one. So I was looking at that, but I was also realistic. Like, there was good competition there. There were former world champions there lined up. There were world record holders lined up there. So, I was well aware that the field was going to have its challenges, and all I could do was control what I did and how I prepared and how I executed on the day. And that's what kind of kept me focused, that I was sort of like, I can't get bogged down on who's there and what they've run. I just need to run my own races and do what I can. And that's what's going to give me the best chance at the results that I would hope for, you know.
And how did you prepare? How did you control the controllables?
Well, it was a very long year, I could tell you that much, since Paris. I moved training group, and I've had the continued support out in Sport Ireland and the Institute with so many of the amazing staff there. And I suppose, like, that village of people, honestly, is how you prepare. You can't arrive at a championships like this and come away with two golds by yourself. It's just not possible. You know, we have the support, you know, on the track, in the gym, physio, sports psych, nutrition, all of that stuff comes together. So to have that support all year, that's ultimately how you make it to these moments. And being really mindful of the fact that this was quite a long season, and you know, our traditional seasons would finish probably in August, and then for this to finish at the end of September, as well as being the year after a games, made it quite tricky to navigate. And a lot of athletes would have picked up injuries and struggled with this year. And it was a tough year, but I think we just kept our eyes on what was ultimately the goal, and that was these championships and these results, and that kept us on track, thank God.
Let's talk about your 100 meters, the first gold. You won it in a championship record. Was that just like the cherry on top?
Yeah. Ah, absolutely. Like, look, I knew it was a time that I was capable of. It's more or less the same as my PB that I run earlier in the year. Also into a headwind, which is like, athletes get greedy, you know, like you go out there and you win a gold and you have a championship record and you're buzzing, you're delighted. And then you see that there was a minus wind and you're like, if it had been behind me, like, what could have been? What could have been? You're like, I need to give over. Like, that is just, that's pure athlete greed. So like, I know, I was delighted. And like, to win it was so special, and that was really ultimately my goal. But to get a championship record alongside it and to run as close to my PB as is possible, like, at the end of the season, and like, yeah, I was just really delighted, and I suppose that was, yeah, big cherry on top.
And it's also in India. Like, it's not like you just cross the river or cross the pond. Like, it was a lot of travel and a lot of like preparing for a different environment. Like,
absolutely.
How satisfied were you with your kind of that sort of preparation, to making sure that you were hydrated enough and dealing with the food?
Yeah, look, I suppose for us, we were kind of, in the few weeks before we traveled, we were doing heat chamber work and saunas. And so the kind of the sports physiology team in the Institute of Sport supported a lot of us with that, which was really important. And that helps kind of break the back of it. So we went on our camp to Dubai, because again, the stopping in Dubai put us closer in terms of time zone and closer in terms of climate and environment. And so we did our kind of last few sessions out there, and that was definitely like instrumental in preparing. Kind of, you could go through your warm-up routine, you could go through the sessions and kind of understand how you're feeling, where you needed to add a rep, take one away, add in some recovery, you know. And you get to trial all those kind of different strategies that you've played out with nutrition, or you've played out with sports physiology around hydration and nutrition. And then when we came into India, we only came in 3 or 4 days before the champs, because we'd been able to break the back of that in Dubai. And then I suppose for me, there was a little bit of a unique challenge, because I have a nut allergy, and being in India, obviously there's nuts in so much of the food. So we had many different strategies and plans in order to keep safe, because if I was to have a reaction, that would just, my performance would be out the window. And so David Tobin was great, and he and I sat down and made loads of plans and strategies, and I ate the most boring and plain and tragic food of my life for the week before. But I was very glad, because it kept me safe and it got me across the line in one piece, and now I can enjoy the beautiful curries that India has to offer.
Please don't get a reaction.
I promise I'll be safe, Mom.
After your 100 meters, you obviously went on, did the 200 and got another gold. Did you think winning the gold in the 100 meter was literally like, yes, I'm here, I'm ready, I can do the double here?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, undoubtedly, that win in the 100 and that confidence from the 100 was what carried me into that too, feeling so good and feeling so strong. And I suppose, like, that Brazilian girl who was second in the 100, she would have come traditionally from a 400 back down, but 400 background down to those kind of shorter distances, and she's broken the world records in both the 1 and 2 this year. So I knew that she was strong, and I was kind of like, God, if I don't get out and put her under pressure, the race is over. Like, she's going to have the wheels that I'm not going to have later on in the race. Like, I'm never going to be able to come back at someone in the last 50 and a 200. But if I can get out hard enough and far enough in front and just hope that that puts them into a kind of a bit of a moment of panic and saying like, oh, she's actually further than I thought she'd be, or it's going to be harder to catch her, and then hope that they overthink things or they tense up. And I think ultimately that's what led to the 200 win, was being able to go out and hold Ryan off. Like, I know she was on my shoulder nearly the whole way around, and I just think that pressure from being just that one step ahead of her out of the blocks made the difference. And to me, I think I was able to get that step and put that distance between us because of that confidence from the one. I just was like, yeah, there's no reason I can't do this again, you know?
Yeah. Paraathletics in Ireland obviously has a great history of success, with the greatest mm-hmm. Paralympian of all time, Jason Smith, being at the forefront until he retired. And yeah. He is a 100, 200 meter runner. Has he been in touch with yes. you since your win?
He has indeed. Jason is great. He always stays in touch with the athletes, and you know, you run into him when you're out on the campus, and he's always been a great support and a great mentor. But he's also been a huge inspiration to so many of us and to me for sure. Like, you know, Greta and I were speaking this week, and we said, like, our first games was in Rio. It was our first games together, and she ran the 1500 and I ran the 100. And in those events, Jason won the 100. Michael McKillop ran the 1500 and won gold in that. And I said to Greta, like, oh, it's amazing. I can't believe that. Like, they're both world champions. And Greta said, like, that's going to be us one day. Oh. I was like, oh, is she mad? Is she
and
mad?
It was.
And then she turned it around was, the other
it
day.
It literally yeah. was. It was you guys on the 28th of September.
Exactly. And she was like, look, I told you this would happen. I told you 9 years ago this would be us. And like, oh, it's just so surreal. Like, she had that belief 9 years ago. So shout out to her for that manifestation.
Orla Comerford, Paralympic bronze medalist and now double world champion. Get used to that title. Thank you for joining
God,
me.
That feels mad. This is 2FM's
Game On. That feels mad, but hopefully something Orla can get used to. Great section of an interview. We will podcast that full interview on the Game On podcast channels this evening, Ellen. But 28 years of age, a bronze at Paris. Now, double world champion, and you take into context that the Brazilian opponent there that came second set a world record earlier this year. So is Orla peaking at the moment, or is the best still to come?
Oh, I think she's just beginning. I think she's just stepping into her moment. I think LA will be her games. I think she has so much potential. I think the most impressive thing about Orla is that she did spend a long time being injured. She had to deal with so many niggles, and just when she thought that she might be in a position to compete again, she got injured again. So the fact that she has been able to just keep her head down and keep believing, I think, is the most impressive thing about her. So I think when she stands up and she competes now, she's already gone through the hard stuff. This is everything that she's been working on and working towards, and she knows that if she can get through that, she can get through this. So it's just so exciting to see. And I think her winning her bronze medal last year at the Games made her realize, okay, yes, this is my moment. And she's really stepping into it. She's a great role model, great ambassador for the sport. And as you can hear from her, she's a great speaker. So she's going to enjoy this so much, and I think it's just gonna fuel her the next couple of years. And like LA, like she, I'm not gonna, do you know the whole thing about sprinters have this like big personality? I think Orla has that big personality where she can enjoy it, she can embrace it, and she's not afraid to take on the world record holder. Like, that is so impressive. That world record was only set in July of this year, so for her to go ahead and beat the Brazilian and then go on and beat her again is just amazing. So I think just watch this space, there's more to come.
That fearlessness is absolutely brilliant. For Greta then, again with a view looking ahead, and we mentioned at the start there, overcoming the obstacles of missing out on podiums and now getting a first ever world championship medal, and for it to be a gold medal as well, how much will that stand to her now going forward?
Definitely. Greta just has this resilience, and she loves running. Like, she just loves training. She loves running. She loves pushing herself. As I said, I had the privilege of seeing it. But if you look at the field that she was competing in, Greta, like everyone else, got season's best, personal best. That wasn't even a personal best or season's best for Greta, but she was still able to perform and still able to bring that performance and have that gold medal. So maybe it's that she has the resilience, and maybe it's that kind of belief and that mindset that she was missing at the major championships, that when it came to the major championships, I don't know, it might have just been playing in the back of her mind. But now that she has that gold medal, that's that belief that maybe she needed. So definitely. And just to kind of live off Orla's energy as well, like they're in this together, and they talked about Michael and Jason, and for so many years on the para athletics team on Team Ireland, Michael McKillop and Jason Smith were just untouchable, winning gold medals left, right and centre. And perhaps this is just a changing of the guard, and this is what we're going to see between these two girls.
Well, here's hoping for more success for Orla and Greta, and indeed for Lana Sutton, a star of the future, her first World Championships and a PB. So brilliant stuff. Ellen Kane, thank you very much for detailing all of that. We're turning our attention to racing. Stick with us here in Game On.
Game On. Racing.
Now Jane Mangan joins us on the line to chat racing. Jane, weather not great here at home. It's raining in France at the moment as well. Might that be a factor? Looking forward to the ARC weekend?
It's going to be a big factor, but in recent renewals of the ARC, it wouldn't really be the ARC without a bit of rain. So I think the rain is to stop at 11 a.m. tomorrow, but it has been persistently raining there since lunchtime today. So that's going to take an effect, and it'll definitely impact the markets as we look towards 8 Group 1s across the 2 days.
Okay, well, let's start with tomorrow before we work our way towards the big one on Sunday. So a couple of Group 1s, including the Pre-Royal 4 p.m. couple of Irish horses in that, Christophe Soumillon on Bedtime Story for Aidan O'Brien.
Yeah, big weekend for Christophe. Every weekend's a big weekend if you're a top flight rider like he is, but he's de facto the number one for Ballydoyle this weekend, so major chances for him. Bedtime Story, it's her first time at this trip, a mile six, so it's going to be a test for her, but she's run some big races in Group 1s already this year. But William Haggis's Santorini Star, Francis Graffard's Latakia, they're probably worthy adversaries. Francis Graffard's won 10 Group 1s already this season. His contender is interesting because she didn't actually run until she was a 4-year-old. Unraced at 2, unraced at 3, they persevered, and Latakia has won 3 of her 4 starts. But she might be the most potent challenger to Bedtime Story, but it's a big stamina test for the favourite, and I'm not sure she'll relish it.
Okay. We also have another Group 1, as I mentioned a little bit earlier on tomorrow, the Prix de Cadran. What catches your eye?
Yes, so that's a 2.5 mile contest. What was most interesting earlier in the week about this race is that there was only 3 horses left in it. So 5 horses supplemented to run. The 5 horses that supplemented to run are afterthoughts. They are probably running for place prize money because it looked such a weak race when there was only 3 in it. To me, to my eye, this is Coltrane's race to lose. He's an 8-year-old. This is not a Group 1 by nature, although it is in name. It's a disappointing renewal of the race, and the Kerry man, Oisin Murphy, may well get on the board courtesy of Coltrane and Andrew Balding in that.
Okay, that's tomorrow. Sunday, so the big one, the ARC. 16 runners declared. Aidan O'Brien has Minnie Hawk, who is the joint favourite.
She's currently favoured, actually, as I read, at 7-2 ahead of Avonsure. Now, the rain is one factor for her that might be an unknown. Her best form this year is probably on good or better. Maybe it was a bit slow when she won the Oaks at Epsom, but it certainly wasn't soft. Avonsure, the filly who's currently second favourite, she was second in the race last year, and she's had the perfect campaign for French Connections this time around. For me, Shane, this is the biggest race in Europe of the year. It's the one I most look forward to. There's 17 left in the race as it stands. Estrange is a non-runner. Aside from the French, there's some interesting Japanese contenders. Oisin Murphy rides Byzantine Dream. Croix du Nord is in there. He's after beating Darriz in his trial. Andrew Balding has got Kalpana. The champion Irish jockey Colin Keane goes over to ride her in the first time cheek pieces. She too would actually relish slow ground if the rain were to come in time for her. Aidan O'Brien, obviously he's got Minnie Hawk, but he's also got Los Angeles equipped with cheek pieces for the first time. He, at the time of reading, is 28-1. He is, after being targeted at this race all season, he's a horse that was fancied for the race last year as a 3-year-old, and he came third. I think if the rain does come, I think Los Angeles is a massive each-way price. And the other Irish runners are White Birch, Dylan Brown McMonagall's ride, and the outsider of the party is hot as hell for Jessica Harrington and Shane Foley. But a fabulously deep international field has assembled for what is the biggest race in Europe.
Okay, you mentioned the perhaps the each way shout, but who might you be siding with outright?
Outright, I like Aventure. She's drawn in 12 as opposed to Mini Hawk, who's drawn in stall 1, which can be tricky because she's going to need a lot of luck and running. And I think Aventure is a little bit unlucky not to beat Blue Stocky in the race last year. So she's by See the Stars, who managed to win the race, remember, all those years ago under Mick Cavanagh for John Ox. And I think she'd be the one I'm with.
Okay, that's the big one. That's the couple of group ones. So on the undercard, they'll have some nice two-year-olds on show.
Yeah, this is just a fabulous card. And if you can't get to France, this is one to tune in for. Diamond Necklace, the winner, she was so impressive in the Ingeble Stakes and Irish Champions weekend at Leopardstown for Aidan O'Brien and Christophe Soumillon. She's currently favourite for the Marcel Boussac ahead of Carol Burke's Aylin. That looks like a fabulous race. Also in top of the market there is Green Spirit for Christopher Head. She's 4 from 4. Christopher Head saddles the favourite for the Prix Jean-Luc Lagardère with a horse called Nighttime, a Wooten Basset horse of the Wertheimer brothers, ahead of Rafe of the Aga Khans. Aidan O'Brien saddles Puerto Rico in that. He's currently 3rd favourite. Not a big field, just a field of 9 go to post for the Prix Jean-Luc Lagardère. The sprint race, current favourite is Asfura. She will drift with this rain that's falling. She doesn't particularly like rain softened ground. And while the Irish are represented in it, she's quality is currently double figure odds for Jack Davidson and James Ryan, a big runner for them on a big day. And the other group ones on the card is the Prix de la Forêt and the Prix de l'Opera. The Prix de l'Opera is a race I'm very much looking forward to. Aidan O'Brien saddles January in there. See the Fire is currently favoured for Oisin Murphy. Joseph O'Brien's got We Might Take the Long Way. Jessica Harrington's got Bar Navara. Paddy Toomey's got One Look. So an awful lot of Irish interest in the Prix de l'Opera. And in the Prix de la Forêt, it's going to be a fascinating race with Zarigana, that tricky, quirky, but really talented filly of the Aga Khans. She's currently 2nd favourite. She's dropping back a furlong on trip. Current favourite is More Thunder for William Haggis. Aidan O'Brien has got exactly in the race. And it's a massive field that's assembled. But I think Zarigana is fascinating dropping back in trip.
OK, brilliant stuff. Jane Mangan, thank you for detailing all of that. Domestic action, of course, at the Curragh and Goran Park tomorrow and on Sunday in Tipperary and Killarney. But focus firmly on Longchamp in Paris this weekend.
Game on.
Racing.
This is
2FM.
Game on.
Association football.
Now, Paul Currie is still with us to chat football. Fergal Brennan joins us on the line. Fergal, we teased this out at the top of the show with Paul about Ange being under a bit of pressure, becoming the first Forest manager for 100 years to fail to win any of his first 6 games in charge. Is he under pressure? Is he going to last?
I think he's under massive pressure. And I think the whole situation at Forest is quite toxic. The fans justifiably are angry with the ownership because they were quite happy with Nuno Santo in place, qualified for Europe last season. Didn't have a great start to the current campaign, granted, but was still very popular with the fans. The owner has made this decision to remove him from his position and has brought in a manager that absolutely polarises opinion. As we saw at the back end of last season, finally ended Tottenham's wait for a trophy, but they were dreadful in the Premier League. And he has... there's huge doubts over his ability to be a Premier League manager. And based on the first few weeks, there's very little to work off. I actually do feel a little bit sorry for him because he's been thrown into a situation he's not got much control over, but I don't think it was ever going to be much better than it is right now.
Okay, Forest away to Newcastle, where Eddie Howe says he's 100% committed to Newcastle amid Manchester United links. Fergus, just stick with yourself because I know you covered the Liverpool beat. So Liverpool have confirmed that Alisson is not expected to be available until after the November international break. They play Chelsea at Stamford Bridge tomorrow evening, 5:30 kickoff. How much of a test will this be for Liverpool, considering they've been bailed out with a couple of late winners and people are saying that's the sign of champions, or that's a sign of champions showing their fragility?
Well, they got a bit of a taste of their own medicine at Palace last weekend, where they scored late on and then Palace scored even later to win the game. And obviously midweek out in Galatasaray, it is a difficult place to go. There's been kind of a few raised eyebrows about Slot's comment of the noise and the atmosphere being hostile and difficult for his team to produce in. They probably did enough to get a point out in Turkey, but they didn't. Long trip all the way back to England to prepare for a big game this weekend. So I think there is pressure and there is a lot of focus more and more on the new players that have come in. Because with the exception of, Hugo Ekitike. There is question marks over Frimpong, Gyökeres and Wirtz. Wirtz in particular because of the amount of money that's been spent. Some of it for me is a little bit unjustified. I think he will click. He's a very, very talented player. But the manager has a responsibility to manage this now. The international break arguably comes at a good time if they get a positive result against Chelsea, because he can kind of allow those players to go away. He said already that this is the last little window for Alexander Isak to get up to full fitness. When he comes back at the back end of this month, the expectation is that he'll be ready, all guns blazing. So there is pressure on Slot, but there's a lot of pressure now on how do all these new players fit into the team. They've had a couple of months, with the exception of Isak, to settle and get adjusted. And other than Ekitike, there's question marks on all of them in terms of where they fit, are they ready? And obviously, Isak's adjustment now creates a situation whereby, does he play with Ekitike? Does Ekitike get shuffled out wide? Does one of them get benched because Salah's not going to be benched? So they need a result just to maybe kind of kick some of those questions down the road. But once we come back after the international break, there will be a lot of focus on how Arne Slot handles this.
Okay, Paul Carrier, Weekly, Ruben Amorim chat. He says his system is not to blame for the poor results. What is to blame, so?
Yeah, I don't think it's completely on the system. I do think when you look at the Manchester United squad and the players that they have, they would be more suited to maybe that 4-2-3-1 that a lot of teams play. You can think of Fernandes playing off a front man, Mbeumo, Cunha and Sesko being kind of those other front three players, and people kind of can see that taking shape. I still think, though, it's the same group of players who are going to produce similar types of results. I would agree in the sense that it's not solely down to the formation. These players have been around this club, the majority of them, for a long, long period of time and have consistently produced poor performances and poor results. And tomorrow, Shane, is not a game that Amorim can afford to not win. At home to Sunderland, Sunderland will be identifying that game and thinking, nothing to fear here, go out and enjoy ourselves and potentially pick up points. So irrespective of the system or the players that he plays tomorrow, it has to be a win for Manchester United.
Yeah, against the Sunderland side that have an identity that can adapt to in-game change as well, that perhaps that has been lacking with Manchester.
And who have four more points than Manchester United.
Which is, yeah, for it is great to see, actually, the promoted teams. We touched on this earlier in the week as well, but Sunderland fifth in the table, 11 points on the board. I know Burnley in the relegation zone, but Leeds going well at 11th. Leeds at home to Spurs. You mentioned Manchester United at home to Sunderland. Arsenal against West Ham, looking to keep the pressure on Liverpool. Just on the international side of things as well, actually caught my eye, Fergal. Is there much fallout over the England squad that Thomas Tuchel has selected?
I think for some fans, are kind of looking at form players who've not been selected. Jack Grealish, Phil Foden are probably the two jump out ones. But one of the main reasons that Thomas Tuchel was hired by the English FA is that he's not afraid to make his own decisions. He will back himself. He kind of answers to nobody. He's quite prickly in press conferences. We saw that when he announced the squad, and he was very quick to say that he'd spoken to Jude Bellingham and one or two other players that were not included, to say there's no issue here. It's either a fitness or a tactical or a kind of match ready stance that he's taking. There will be fallout because the England job is obviously a very difficult one. There's a lot of England fans that think they know better and who should be in and who should not be in. But form doesn't always domestic form doesn't always necessarily translate to the national team. And also, a lot of these players that are being championed to be brought in haven't necessarily produced for England on a consistent basis. Tuchel's first few months in charge of England hasn't been massively inspiring, but they haven't missed a beat. They're going to qualify for the World Cup. And realistically, that's when he'll be judged in where are we now? 9 months' time, there or thereabouts.
Okay, final one for you, Paul Carey. Briefly, can Keith Andrews mastermind a victory over Manchester City?
Oof. He'll certainly make it difficult for them. I'm not sure if he'll have enough there to get 3 points. Haaland on the score sheet during the week. Difficult one. A point would be a brilliant result for him.
Okay, great. So, Fergal Brennan, thank you very much. Paul Carey, thank you very much. You mentioned at the top of the show the matches that are off. Just a reminder, Cork against Pats, FAI Cup semi-final is on, as is Athlone Town against Dundalk and Cove Ramblers against Bray Wanderers. That is all we have time for this evening. Many thanks for listening. Marie and Ruby return with Game On Monday at 6 p.m. Up next here on 2FM, the official chat show with the brilliant Hugh Carr. So do not go anywhere. Today's show was produced by Ronan Lawler, and our broadcast coordinator was Demi Geraghty. So for myself, Shane Dawson, and all of the Game On team, have a great weekend. It is bye for now.